Welcome to the AquariumX audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 57, recorded April 11th, 2011.
Welcome, everyone.
Hello.
To yet another episode.
I can talk a little bit better this week.
Yeah. So we'll all have a lot of fun deciphering your...
My bizarre head cold speech patterns.
No, I don't think it's that bad at all. I think you sound fine.
Sound like a choking frog so much.
No. Have you ever heard a choking frog?
No, but I imagine that's kind of what it sounded like.
Oh, okay. Well, here we go.
Okay, we have a message from Chris, and it was about the wetlands video. The tour that Russ took when he was down in Louisiana. We had asked if anybody knew what kind of fish those were to let us know.
This was episode 53, by the way.
Oh, yes. The one that talks about the wetlands. And Chris was thinking... He wasn't sure, but he thought it looked like a kind of fundulus. He thought maybe either fundulus chrysotus or fundulus singulatus. Did I say that approximately...
Yeah, everybody says it their own way. You know, I say it my own way. Some people would say fundulus cingulatus. Some people would say fundulus cingulatus. You know, whatever. Nobody
fundulus
speaks.
Fundulus cingulatus.
Yeah, you can
sounds
say that
cooler.
Too. Yeah, there you go.
Latin. Okay, so that was his idea. So did you look those up?
I did, and I think he's right. Yeah. I think, I don't know which one it is, but it's one of those. It's got to be, or something very similar to it. Definitely a fundulus, which, by the way, are killies.
Oh. Okay.
Killifish. So they're closely related to live bearers.
There we go.
They're just the egg-laying side of the family, so to speak.
The egg-laying side of the live-bearing.
Yeah.
Well, the side of the live-bearing family that doesn't bear live young.
Well, they are actually really close related there. They talk about the live-bearing tooth carps and the egg-laying tooth carps. So basically, the live-bearing tooth carps are the, you know, poecilids and their close relatives, and the egg-laying tooth carps are the killifish.
Okay.
So there you go. And in some cases, like the least killifish, Heterandria formosa, is actually a live-bearer. It's called, one of its names is the least killifish. Another one is the eastern mosquito fish.
Oh.
But, yeah, there you go. So they're closely allied. They look... fairly similar because they're related.
There we go.
And
now, do we have pictures of these up on the resources page of these two species that he's thinking it might be?
We don't yet, but I could put some up. Right now, I did put a time-stamped link to the YouTube video so that if you click on the link, it just shows up right at the fishy part.
The fishy
part.
Of the
video. And I've annotated it, so thank you, Chris. I've annotated it, so now if somebody watches it, it doesn't just say what we are saying, but an annotation pops up while you're watching that says, Chris G. mentioned that these could likely be fundulus, you know, something like that, species, and we think he's right. So thank you, Chris, for pointing that out. And
very
whoever
nice.
Watches it in the future will find that out, too.
So thank you.
Oh, he also mentioned... Sorry. Didn't mean to step on your words there. He also mentioned that he really enjoys listening to the show on his iPod, and it's been interesting and informative, and that he also has a 55-gallon planted community tank, 9 smaller tanks with killies, dwarf cichlids, and a few other small fish.
Awesome. He's got other killies.
Yeah, yeah. So I thought maybe
nice
we should bring
to
that
hear.
Up, too. But yeah, there you go. So once again, thank you, Chris.
Yes. Mystery fish is solved. Okay, we're going to move on to Google Voice. Now we have a message from Stuart, and this is kind of cool because Stuart is our first caller from out of the U.S. He's from London. So thank you, Stuart, for calling, so we all get to hear your way groovy accent. We love accents. They rock.
They do. So they really it's do. Fun that you're adding some international flavor.
It's very cool.
And... I hope the Google Voice didn't cost you too much, because I understand that it does have, there's some sort of charge attached to it when you're calling internationally. But one thing for the future, everyone, if you want to call internationally, you can always just send us an MP3 or a WAV file, and we can embed it in the show, as long as it, you know, sounds good enough so that everybody can hear it, mm-hmm. we'll do that too. So that works as well. Just send it an email.
Yeah.
We can try that. Unless somebody starts to send us nasty viruses or something, then we have to quit. But
we
know none of you would do that. So anyway, that was a long way to say thank you, Stuart, for calling. Now we'll get to your actual question.
Okay, here goes his message.
Hey, Aquamax, it's Stuart from London. Basically, just wondering, when you're keeping a beta or beta, so, Siamese fighter, for those who pronounce beta differently, why have you got to have the Indian, those leaves, the Indian almond leaves, or whatever they are? I've always wondered that, and I'm starting a new tank soon, so that'd be some really great information. Love the show. Thank you very much. Bye.
So, that was super fun.
Yeah, it was.
Why don't you tell us a bit about the Indian almond tree to start out with?
All right. I think the first thing that we should say is that this is not the same as the almond tree that gives the almonds you get in cans at the store to eat.
Roasted almonds.
The roasted almonds, honey-roasted almonds, mixed nuts, all those kinds of things. Yeah, it's not the same tree. The almond tree that produces the almonds people normally eat is the Prunus genus, which contains a lot of the common fruits that we like, such as peaches and so on. So the almond nuts are closely related to peaches. This other tree is an entirely different beast altogether. It's not an almond tree at all.
Why do they call it an almond tree?
Well, they call it an almond tree because the nuts are similar in shape, very similar in shape, but much larger. And they're rock hard, ridiculously hard. In some places of the world, they eat them during famines because they can't bother to eat them any other time because they're just too hard. So you have to.
How do they get them open?
With rocks. they're very hard. I think I tried to bash one open once with a rock.
And it didn't work.
Just bounced a few times first.
Wow.
We used to live in Hawaii, as most of you may already know, and they grow all over in Hawaii.
They were actually really pretty.
Yeah, they're very nice
Since
trees.
Since there's no fall in Hawaii, those were kind of the closest we'd get to fall foliage, is that the leaves would turn red.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, the leaves turn red and fall off, I think in preparation for the dry season, usually. On our side of the island, there wasn't that much of a dry season.
We were on the rainy side of the island, so there wasn't a dry season.
Not really. Although there was a less wet season, I guess, sort of.
Sort of.
At least it didn't rain for 30 days straight during the
less
wet season.
Well, it rained, but it was 95 instead of, you know, 75 or 80. That's about how it was, so.
It didn't rain as much.
And it didn't rain quite as much.
Yeah. But anyway, yes. So the tree is called, the scientific name is Terminalia catappa, and they're also known as catappa trees and about a million other names. I can't remember the Hawaiian name, that's sad. I can't remember it.
Look it up.
Yeah. But anyway, they were all over. Beautiful trees. And the idea is, why use them with betas? Why are they so popular with beta keepers? That was the essence of Stuart's question. So let's get into that. Well, betas come from natural conditions where their water's, you know, fairly still, and there's usually some decaying vegetable matter in the water.
Such as leaves,
yeah. And as we know, many plant parts that decay in water tend to release organic acid, such as tannic acid. And so the water tends to get a bit acid, and it can sometimes get, if there's a lot of it, can get kind of tea-colored.
That was tea-colored, not pea-colored.
Right, although that could conceivably happen as well.
We can go back and cut that
part
out.
No, we're not going to. It's okay. So you get the acid water, somewhat acid water, and betas, you know, they tend to be in areas that are kind of like that with the decaying vegetation. And part of the rationale for the Indian almond leaves is that if the water is more like home, the conditions are likely to be better for the fish and just kind of induce them to spawn more effectively.
So the point is to get acid water. So I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Do they have Indian almond trees where the betas are from that they're using these leaves? Or is there a reason why it has to be Indian almond leaves? Do they make more acid than other tree leaves? If there's just random floating vegetable matter decaying in the water, why specifically Indian almond?
Okay, that's a good question. Different plant material contains different proportions of different things, including acids. That's part of the answer. So the profile of Indian almond leaves tends to have the right proportions of acids to work for bettas. I would tend to say there must be quite a few Indian almond leaves in the areas where bettas come from. I know that they are widespread around the world.
So that tree does grow there.
And I know that betta breeders in Thailand and so on use them. So okay. I'm certain they grow there.
Okay.
And they grow in Indonesia, and they grow in Hawaii, and they grow... There are so many places in the world they grow. They're pretty widespread trees. So I'm sure they do. And we'll talk more about... As we continue, we'll kind of answer some more of that specifically, of what you said. About why specifically Indian almond tree, but they do have a profile that works well for bettas in terms of the types of acids they produce and so on. Another issue that it's believed that acid water can lead to kind of a toughening of the skin in a fish, which makes it a little bit more difficult for parasites to attack them and so on. There are some people who say that, and so that kind of makes sense. And one nice thing is that when water is more acid, it tends to have... Well, okay, we're going to go back to ammonia again. It's all about ammonia and surface area.
I was just going to say, surface area.
Okay, ammonia, when it is in water with a high alkalinity, high pH and so on, tends to be more toxic. When it's in water that's more acid, it changes to ammonium. Okay, there's an ionic thing going on. It changes to ammonium, and ammonium is less likely to pass into a fish's tissues, and so it's less toxic because it's the way it's charged and so on. So if you are using Indian almond leaves in betta water, and you're keeping bettas in a pot, you know, outside, and you live in the tropics or something like that, and you have acid water because that's what you're doing, the ammonia that builds up is not going to be as toxic because it's going to be ammonium instead.
That's a good thing.
So that's a good reason to use the leaves. And, of course, the same thing is true even if you're in an aquarium with filtration. It's still going to be more acid, and there's going to be more ammonium instead, and so ammonia is less likely to be an issue, but hopefully it wouldn't be an issue anyway because you have good filtration and so on. There are many who believe that the... extract from the leaves, or the compounds and substances released by the leaves, have antifungal and antimicrobial qualities that are just good for bettas. So I think that's it pretty much in a nutshell. They're even used as medicines for people and so on in some places of the world. If you want to check it out, I put a link on the resources, podcast resources page, to IndianAlmondLeaves.com. It just talks a little bit about them in general, including aquarium use, but also other uses of the tree and so on.
Okay.
We need to see if we have a picture. We've got to have a picture somewhere.
Oh, yes. I'm sure we have a picture.
Because Kekela Beach was full of them.
It was full of them.
And they were all over the place.
So we'll try to get a picture up for you guys.
Yeah.
It might have one of our adorable children in it.
Yeah, it might be.
I'm sure you won't mind.
Yeah, probably not. So there you go.
So thank you, Stuart.
Good question.
Okay. Oh, our next little tidbit for today... we were talking about darrow worms a few weeks ago, and we found some more in one of our tanks.
Yes, one of
Speak
our
of the worm
did.
And it shall appear, you know. Yeah. Our 5-year-old found it, actually. She's very into the fish. She likes to look and see what she can see in the fish tanks. But so we made a little video, and it's up on YouTube.
So you can see what a darrow worm looks like.
Go see the darrow worms and see if you have them, too.
Yeah. I already put it up on Facebook for those of you who follow us on Facebook. Thank you, by the way, to those of you who added yourselves, and thank you, by the way, to those who continue to contribute via Facebook.
Yay.
That's very nice. We're enjoying that, and we're up to record numbers now. We have more Facebook adherents than we have ever had before, I guess.
Woo-hoo.
That's the way it usually goes. But
we should have a party on Facebook. We'll all, like, type smiley faces, and maybe we can, like, make a way to type streamers.
There you go.
I don't know.
Ooh, virtual streamers.
Yeah, virtual party.
Anyway, but...
Code break! This isn't a commercial, because it's not trying to sell you anything. It is, however, the part where we shamelessly encourage you to be a part of the Aquarimax audio show by calling and leaving a message any time of the day or night at 801-477-0629. If you don't want to actually talk, but you do have a comment or question, you can just send us an email to info@aquarimax.com. There. That wasn't so painful now, was it? Okay, we're not back. We're back.
Okay. So what's next?
Next. Okay, you were going to tell us some more on the brine shrimp.
Brine shrimp. Indeed, I was. Do you remember how we talked about, as an afterthought, I put a few extra brine shrimp from hatching some for fish into an Opaiula tank?
Yes, I did.
Brackish water shrimp.
And they turned out to be very nice neighbors.
Yeah. Strangely enough, I was just expecting them to be eaten, picked off by the Opaiula in their little brackish environment. But they survived. Well, some of them did. Not all of them did. But enough of them did that there were a number of adults in there. And then they began to reproduce. Now, I think it was when I came back from New Orleans, wasn't it? I noticed the first batch of babies in there. So mid to late March, I noticed a batch of babies in there. Some of those are nearly adults now. So it's been two or three weeks. But there are two more cohorts in there.
Cohorts?
Yes. So we could say batches of babies, I suppose. They're not necessarily
Is that litters. What they call a batch of baby brine shrimp? Is a cohort?
Not specifically to brine shrimp, but a more scientifically appropriate academic term for a batch, because so you know you're referring to animals being born or hatched instead of cookies, for example. You know, you can say cohort.
I've never heard that. That's like partners in crime kind of word. That's I gotta say that's an odd one.
Yeah, but if you look it up on a concordancer or a corpus.
Why don't they say clutch? Usually things that are laid in eggs are clutches. Of course, I guess they're not laying them in eggs at the moment.
Well, that's the funny thing. I don't even know yet because, as you may know, brine shrimp can reproduce in at least two ways. Mm-hmm. One, they lay cysts, which can then be dried and then rehydrated later and so on and
so
survive that way.
It's a cyst and not an egg? They don't call it an egg?
Well, it's like an egg. It starts out as an egg, but it's got this covering around the egg and it is arrested. Its development is arrested in a stage where the cell division has already occurred several times. And it started to develop. I mean, not just develop. I mean, it's developed quite fairly far before it goes inactive into diapause. But there's that kind that it can reproduce that way. But if conditions are favorable to it, they can also basically lay really thin-shelled eggs that hatch immediately or almost immediately.
So it's almost live birth.
Yeah. They don't have a placenta or anything, but so ovoviviparous rather than viviparous.
You just like to say that.
It's kind of a fun
ovoviviparous
word.
Ovoviviparous. Look at my vocabulary.
No, that's not why I do it.
Oh, I know.
I just love that word.
It's just such a good word. Ovoviviparous. All those V's. How many words can boast that many V's?
I know. It's kind of cool.
That's a pretty sweet word.
So they reproduce these two ways, but I'm not sure which way, because I seem to see cysts floating in the tank periodically in the water column, and I haven't been adding them.
Have to dry out before and get water added to them again before they will hatch, or will they just eventually hatch if they stay in the water?
That's a great question. That's a great question. I think it depends on the situation. I think, in generally, they're released in conditions in the wild that are unfavorable to hatching. And so they need to get to the good conditions to be able to hatch before they do. But in a captive situation, I'm not sure that that's true. So I'm not sure. That's a good question. Anyway, this is the problem, though. I usually, you know, I'll go in there and look at the container and try to look and see what's going on every day, once or twice, you know, look in there. And one day I'll look in there and not see any really young brine shrimp at all. And I will see little copepods, because they're copepods, and I'm not sure if they came originally from a saltwater tank or a freshwater tank or where they came from. They may have come from either one because I introduced algae from both saltwater and freshwater tanks into there to feed the opayula.
Okay.
Which is probably not the safest thing to do, but anyway, I did. And so now there's these little copepods in there, not cyclops type copepods. They look like marine copepods. They swim in little corkscrew shapes, and they don't have the conspicuous egg cases that cyclops type copepods do that you find in freshwater and that I have in other tanks. So it's a different type. At any rate, they look quite a bit different. They're more elongate than baby brine shrimp. And they swim in a corkscrew motion rather than just a jerky motion. So I don't get them confused.
Mm-hmm.
But one day I'll look in there and not see any baby brine shrimp that are just newly hatched. And the next day, they look 2 days old. They show up and they look 2 days old. So I'm not sure what's going on.
Now, would they hatch down in the rocks being hiding down there? Or?
I don't know. Usually they're not really...
They don't really hide.
Hiders. They just sort of jerk around the water and they don't know what's going on there. They're phototrophic. They go towards the light. Not phototrophic. I just said phototrophic. Phototaxic. That's what I meant. Yeah. They don't eat light. They move towards it. Sorry, folks. I can't believe I just said that. Anyway.
Okay.
They go toward the light. And there you go. So
go towards the light.
They probably wouldn't be hiding down in the rocks and so on. So I don't know what's going on. It's just very interesting to see that more and more of them are appearing.
I know what's going on.
What?
Okay, they're all going, hey guys, this would be so funny if we freak Russ out, we hide the first day, and he won't know what is going on, and we will laugh.
If they're doing that, they have a lot more intelligence than I attribute to them normally. But that would be cool. I'd be up with that. So now I have a few adults in there. I've got some babies that are several weeks old and starting to, you know, have the secondary sexual characteristics. Another batch that's about a week and a half old that is, they're really small still, but you can see that they have multiple legs and they're swimming in the typical brine shrimp fashion.
that groovy little
and then I've,
feathery.
Yeah, feathery fairy-like
yeah.
movement. And then I've got some really tiny ones that are about 3 days old, maybe, that look like elongated apostrophes swimming around. So there are lots of
them.
That's
a good band name.
Yeah, it kind of is.
Elongated apostrophes.
Yeah. See, there you go.
That's pretty sweet. So what are you feeding them right now? What are they eating?
Well, I do put powdered spirulina in the tank for the opayula. And I'm sure they're eating some of that because anything that's small enough, they'll ingest it. Mm-hmm. You know, and powdered spirulina has very small particles in it as well as larger ones.
So brine shrimp kids aren't picky like human kids, huh?
Right. That's a good thing. If kids ate like that, we just kind of flick clouds of food at them, and they would ingest whatever was small enough to be ingested.
That would be
we could
bizarre.
Try that. That'd be interesting.
I don't know. Some of our kids would think that was cool. We just throw food at them.
And they'd open their mouth
and
just
catch it.
Whatever fits. And so I'm sure they're doing that. I'm sure there's some suspended unicellular algae in the tank. I do get, it gets kind of a lot of light, which means the sides of the tank are a little bit covered. Not covered, but they have some algae growth on them. There are undoubtedly some bacteria floating around in the water. I do add some plankton food that I have for my Daphnia, too. I add, you know, a little bit of everything, really. Yeah, I think that's about it. They eat all of those different things. And they seem to be
a nice variety of goo.
Yeah, they seem to be thriving on it, whatever it is. They grow fast and they're happy. They're not in huge numbers, but I'm not concerned about that.
Okay. Now, what's in there with them? It's just the opayula and the copepods?
Well,
or is there anything else in there with them?
The opayula are the Hawaiian red shrimp, and there are the little copepods. There's some kind of hairy algae that grows on there that the opayula keep under control. And then some filmy algae that's growing on the glass. But there are also, I just introduced some olive nerites to help control the algae, and they've been nibbling at that. But that was just a couple of days ago. So
no problems there.
No
yet.
Problems there. The salinity is really low.
No, I don't.
I don't expect any problems with that. The salinity is quite low. There are only about 2 teaspoons, folks, of salt per gallon in there. And it's about a gallon and a quarter size container.
Yeah,
something
it's
like
not
that.
A marine tank. It's not a salt
no,
tank.
No,
it's a
brackish
tank,
and it's a pretty fairly on the low end for brackish. It might be a little higher than that because of evaporation, but It's not that much higher than that. I should go test it. But I'm not going to do that right now. But I'll do that eventually.
It's because you're holding the microphone. You can't go test it right now.
But I will eventually. So there you go. Okay, but I know it's about that much.
So it's not very high.
No.
What's the substrate?
Substrate is crushed lava rock and a little bit of Tahitian wind sand, but not very much. Mostly just lava rock.
And that's kind of, we put that in there mostly for the Opayula because right. They like to go hide in there and do their thing.
Right. And it doesn't seem to be bothering the shrimp at all, the brine shrimp at all.
So what are your plans? I mean, this was kind of a, oh, let's see what happens if we do this. What are you planning on doing in with it now?
Well,
just
I would
leave them there?
I kind of want to keep them in there for a while anyway to see how this goes, but I'm thinking of consolidating because right now on the same shelf I have 3 Opayula habitats, and I'd like to consolidate 2 of those into 1, so we only have a total of 2 there. And when I do that, I think I'm going to upgrade the size of the tank to a 2-gallon instead of a 1.25 plus another 1-gallon. I'm just going to make 1 2-gallon tank and probably put a filter in. Normally I don't like undergravel filters, but with a 2-gallon desktop for this particular purpose, I think I'd do that and just put the airflow on a trickle.
Mm-hmm.
So I can leave a patch of gravel where I can go in and gravel wash and do more frequent water changes. So I can see if I can get a higher density of both Opayula and brine shrimp to do well, just to see.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to be a little bit more of a purist, and since you don't find brine shrimp and Opayula in the same habitat, I don't really want to
mess
with it. It
would be kind of hard to pull them out now, though.
Right. But since I did this by accident, I don't want to just kill them all. That would be awful. So I'm just going to see what happens and, you know, see if I can get them to thrive together just for curiosity's sake.
Okay.
So please don't hate me if you're a purist. I usually am, too, to some extent.
Call it crustacean desegregation.
Yeah.
There you go.
And, well, one thing I'd like to bring up, too, is that on the internet you hear lots of people saying, well, hatching brine shrimp is easy, well, true, but raising them to adulthood is difficult. Well, it can be, but it depends on what you mean, because I think there are really 3 different levels of brine shrimp raising.
Ooh.
There's raising brine shrimp just for curiosity or pets in very small numbers, low density, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that tends to be fairly easy. Then there is raising them for small to moderate amounts of live food, which is a little bit more difficult, but it's still doable. And then there's mass culture. And mass culture is when it really gets hard. If you want to raise huge numbers of brine shrimp to adulthood, it gets expensive. You need more specialized equipment to be able to do high-density brine shrimp raising in an efficient manner. That's tough. That's probably beyond most hobbyists' needs or interest or limits of practicality, but if you want to do just a few small ones and use some of them for live food once in a while, I think that's well within the grasp of many of us. And so we could say that the difficulty is directly proportional to the number and or density that you want to raise. One thing that
you're
I would like to
point out... You're just full of scientific soundings today, aren't you?
No.
That's great.
I'm just being weird.
No,
today,
I'm not
to
that. That's fabulous.
Okay.
We like it.
So one thing, I put a link to Big Bear Husky Musher's system on YouTube. That's
an interesting name as well.
Yeah, he probably runs Huskies.
Probably lives in Alaska.
I'm not sure where Big Bear is. I should know that. I think I do somewhere in my brain, but not right now. But anyway, he probably mushes Huskies.
He probably does.
That's kind of cool. But if he has a cool system for keeping a fairly large number of brine shrimp thriving in it's a nice arrangement. He feeds them spirulina and so on. He's got a little bit of aeration in there. It looks like he's producing a fair number of adults. I mean, he's not going to raise thousands of fish on the amount he's producing, but definitely have enough to give some of your fish a treat once in a while and get them into breeding condition. So check that out. It's a pretty cool video, and he's got other videos on
We put that on the
it's on the resources page.
Yes.
Yeah,
okay.
It is.
Very good. Alrighty.
So, one and all, tune in next week to hear Russ and Kelly talk about something that relates to fish, the precise nature of which we cannot tell you because we have no idea. We're waiting for you to contribute to the show so that we can
come up with something.
All right.
But we do love to hear from you all, so
yes, keep it up.
And anybody else who wants to call in from... I mean, anybody who wants to call in the U.S., of course, is fine, but if anybody else from outside of the U.S. wants to call, that would be fun, too. We could see how many different countries we could have represented on Eclairmax. That would be cool.
All right. Well, this is Russ and Kelly signing off. Best fishes, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Eclairmax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.